downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Coming up on Objection to the Rule, the Trump administration is in the news this week over a conversation with a Gold Star family of a soldier killed in Niger. We'll discuss the controversy and explore why people are up in arms. Plus, e-bikes are on the radar for de Blasio. Find out why he could put the brakes on this form of transportation in the city. And we're joined by the cast and filmmaker of the short film Black People Are Dangerous to explain their film's commentary on race in America. Objection to the Rule is live right now on Radio Free Brooklyn. Good afternoon, Radio Free Brooklyn. You're listening to Objection to the Rule live. I'm Ori Givens, joined in the studio by Rachel Cleary. Hey, Rachel.
Hey.
And we also have a special guest in the studio. Hi, Donaldo.
What's going on?
How are you doing? We're going to find out more about Donaldo and his short film, Black People Are Dangerous, coming up later in the show. I have to apologize for the little bit of dead air at the top of the hour. We're sorry for that, you know, technical difficulties, but we'll keep it rolling. So we got a whole lot of topics to talk about this week on Objection to the Rule. There's been a lot going on in the government. I want to start with the proposal for the tax overhaul, with the Senate approving a budget resolution for the next fiscal year that could possibly overhaul taxes and maybe significantly lower taxes for the wealthy. Is that really what we're looking for? Are lower taxes for the wealthy? Is that where we should be going with tax reform? I'm curious to know what your thoughts are about not just the plan, but how we think we should be exploring changing taxes in our society. Rachel, what do you think?
I feel like this is something I've been hearing throughout my life. Just the whole, should we be cutting taxes for the rich? No, but it seems to happen the way. I think it's a little different now. There's always been different schools of people coming from different economic schools of thought, thinking, well, no, that we should, implement or not implement taxes and say this way here, because it'll have this desired effect on the economy. And someone else would argue, no, that, that's not how that should be done. But those are almost like battling economic theorists, which would actually work. But I feel like now there's a different character to it. There's almost I think people as a whole recognize that there have been our tax system has created a socioeconomic class of super super wealthy people who, and part of why they're able to hold on to so much of their wealth is they're not paying taxes, and people who are earning less are shouldering more of the tax burden. There seems to be this, either you recognize that, hey, maybe we need to contribute more, all of us personally, in order to, and I hate to say reap the benefit more, but it kind of made everything more of a level playing field versus a thinking of that's not that. It's like, why should I have to pay for you? It's almost, there's much more, it seems a little bit more polarized. Why do I have to pay for anything? Someone else's, healthcare. That's why do I have to pay for this? It doesn't seem like, battling economic theorists anymore. It seems like there's a sharper divide. And I don't think the plan, personally, makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, I like the idea of more you pay, more you earn, more you pay in taxes, but I don't know how that's going to affect the very super super wealthy, the Koch brothers. I think they should be paying people who have that kind of wealth.
Well, and this is all in the context of getting a set budget for the next fiscal year. And as a budget is about what money is coming in and what money is going out. So if there's going to be any reduction of taxes, then we have to look at how much money is that going to take away from our revenues? What things are going to get cut, you know, because of that deficit, or if there's going to be a deficit? Now, there's not been an analysis from the Congressional Budget Office to tell us what the impact of these plans could be. But, you know, we know that marginalized communities typically lose out when there's going to be a deficit or when there's going to be a reduction in revenues. And we typically know, you know, we know that there are some targets right now, you know, as far as reproductive health, for instance.
Yes.
And some of these things that, you know, do cost money, but they're services that we need.
Right. And it's that's also, it's costing you money, but what is the economic cost if you don't provide that also?
Exactly.
Is it some of these like, hey, we can afford to cut taxes over here. Well, should we really be cutting taxes though? If we could, I think sometimes we got to kind of move the money around. It's kind of like, oh, if we can say spend less on this thing over here, but that means we can funnel more money into say services that people really need, like certain communities that are, you know, there's certain basic, you know, quality of life issues. You know, it's if you find you have a surplus of money, I don't think the first thing you should do would be, okay, let's cut the taxes then.
Uh-huh.
You might want to like funnel that into a program or providing certain services in communities and places and parts of the country where they're in dire need of that. There are places, you know, and especially when we, in the wake of like these three major hurricanes, causing millions in damages. If you find you have some extra funding, don't cut the taxes. Hey, I'll pay the taxes so that the roads get rebuilt in Florida and in Texas and in Puerto Rico.
You know, they can have power back, know, after a month.
Power. Exactly.
I think it's really, you know, as we have these discussions about budget, it's always kind of been one of those Republican mantras to cut taxes, cut taxes. But cut taxes how and to what end? And I really feel like we have to look at how can we streamline our taxation policies? Because as you know, as a taxpayer, I don't mind paying for people to have health care or for us to have nice roads or for us to, you know, rebuild Puerto Rico. But there are people that are concerned about paying out that money. You know, I can't say right or wrong what they think, but we have to look at what our collective society wants out of our government, what we want it to do, and what services we want it to perform.
Right, and I think that's one of those things where I think a lot of it had to do with this last election cycle where we had someone who is a self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist and, you know, was out there talking very loudly about, hey, here's a different perspective on taxes and monies. Like, hey, you know, hey, if everyone pays a little bit more in taxes, we provide health care, but that's more money in our, it levels out. He was kind of, we have this is in the public consciousness now, this idea of like, oh, wait a second, maybe, you know, taxes they're not such a bad thing. If we see it actually helping people, I think a lot of frustrations come from people who maybe are paying a lot in say property taxes or local income taxes in places where their garbage isn't getting picked up properly. Like basic quality, you know, there's potholes everywhere. They get, you know, they're not I'm paying taxes, but look at what it's like in my neighborhood or my town. And I think that's where a lot of that frustration comes
and
in.
And we're still so early. We really don't have very many details about what this is all going to look like. And it obviously has to go through a whole bunch of vetting. There's going to be a version of the House, a version that goes through the House, a version that goes to the Senate. Eventually they'll kind of get mashed together and then we'll see some sort of budget that comes out of that. I'm curious, Violet, what you thought about the proposals and what you thought of some of the analysis.
It sounds like a lot more of the same, you know. It's the same people who are who feel they don't have a responsibility to the whole. So, and unfortunately, they're writing the tax code now. And we've got, you know, we've got the same people on the Senate and the House. So it looks like they're going to approve and push it through, and then the executive is just going to help that. Unfortunately.
And that's kind of the worst, since there is no, you know, there's not a Democratic majority in the House or Senate. Not that, you know, we can't assume that the Democrats would come out with a better bill, but we can, you know, say that there will probably be more universalized ideals that would come through. It wouldn't benefit one group or another. And it, you know, possibly could save some of these services that are on the radar for chopping.
Right.
Let's transition. Let's talk a little bit about, we keep on talking about North Korea. And it's, I don't mean to laugh, but it's just become this point where it's like every week there is a new threat from one side or the other. This week, North Korea has ratcheted up its threats. The North Korean news agency released a statement saying that the U.S., quote, should expect that it would face an unimaginable strike at an unimaginable time, and also said that Trump himself could be a target for nuclear nuclear warfare. That's the word. So, first of all, if Trump is a target, that's a lot more, you know, you can't really pinpoint people with nuclear warheads. It wouldn't just be one person. Right. Should we worry about these threats? You know, it's been a tit for tat, you know, words going back and forth for several months now. I'm curious what you asked this question, you know, like, should we worry? Right. Should we worry?
Right. I mean, I think it's interesting right now that this is ahead of Trump's trip to Asia, where he may or may not visit the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. And we've sort of got mixed feedback from South Korea about whether they actually want him to do that at this time.
Right.
So it seems almost novelistic, right? Like, Trump is going there. Trump has received a direct threat from the leaders of North Korea saying, you are our target. So what will happen?
I'm curious, what do you think?
Just from everything I've listened to, as far as when it comes to this conversation of North Korea, it sounds like I keep hearing this thing about, like, they just want a seat at the table.
Yeah.
People keep talking about they want a seat at the table as far as being respected now that they have nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And if that is all they want, on the one hand, I'm like, well, yeah, we will acknowledge. If it's going to stop all this, like, going back and forth, because then sure, yeah, we'll acknowledge that you two have a nuclear weapon and you can have that seat at the table that you've been wanting. Because I do feel like if anything's going to happen, it seems like they got so much of their weaponry aimed at South Korea.
Yeah.
And it'll be there that they strike first.
And it would impact the Asia region, I think, a lot more than it would impact us. But that doesn't rule out the fact that it could impact us. You know, we have a large military presence across Asia. We have bases in the majority of those countries. And so I would think that if something did happen and there was a strike in Asia, then that would push the United States to get involved, you know, and that is where the fear comes in, I believe, because, you know, all the kind of talk about, is this going to start World War III? We hope not. But at the same time, you know, destabilizing that region could have a ripple effect.
The latest I heard on this morning on Meet the Press was and see normally I'd be like, you know Kim Jong-un, he's out, we know he's not well be nice, we'll put it that way. Do we want to and the thing is that don't engage somebody like that, like, are we, you know, I think we might be too far past that. We might have to, and Jimmy Carter has offered to go to North Korea. Jimmy, you know, several former presidents got together to actually make a joint statement about Trump, and, you know, this was part of that. And Jimmy Carter's I think his intention in going over there would be to kind of smooth things over and calm everybody down. He kind of has that ability to do that. He in making this statement about in where he offered to go to North Korea, he didn't exactly praise Trump, but he said a few things that weren't unkind, and he said yes, the mainstream media has actually been very harsh on Donald Trump. Yeah, they have, but I mean, Trump does things that maybe result in some outstanding news stories, because I think he started it basically. But anyway, I think that sounded a bit like Jimmy Carter going, okay, that, you know, Trump is someone who wants to have his ego stroked a little bit. I'm going to do that right here. He's clearly kind of got this.
He's a diplomat.
You know, he very much so. Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, but Jimmy Carter has offered to step in and, like, go there. And, you know, so I think at this point, it may be something that needs to be looked at and explored, like, try and just go over there and smooth things over, because we've got these two hotheads going at each other. And, you know,
it's really, you know, kind of an aside. It's really interesting that the five most recent living presidents are kind of unifying together on many fronts. They made an appearance at a benefit, you know, and they're, it is interesting because, as we know, typically former presidents don't speak out and involve themselves in the current affairs of the current administration. And even, you know, former President Obama has been criticized because he hasn't spoken out mm-hmm. as much. But it's kind of it's a courtesy that is given to right. the new administration that the, you know, you're not going to like armchair president. But should they? Do we need more involvement from, you know, our former presidents to maybe say, hey,
I think it speaks volumes that the last two sitting Republican presidents are saying something, because that I think the party yeah. has to take some responsibility for him. But I just, you know, Jimmy Carter could in theory go over there and never come back because it's North Korea.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's saying something that maybe that he's willing to go over there and do this. Like, hey, even I think we need to
chill it out.
Pour an ice bucket on this situation.
Something. Let's talk. Yeah. Let's go to something a little bit less tumultuous. De Blasio seems to want to crack down on electronic bicycles. And if you live in the city, then you've seen, you know, the delivery guys that are riding around on the bikes with the little motors. And I was always, when I first moved here, I was always confused, like, what's happening with these bikes? Like, why are they, like, and they have little motors and they go really fast. And sometimes they get in your way, they might run you over while you're trying to cross the street. And de Blasio is trying to crack down on them, saying that they are unsafe for the city. But it would have a really big effect on a lot of businesses. Slate released an article talking about how this, you know, these bikes don't really cause a lot of the noise and emissions that other forms of transportation cause. And they do help people to make their deliveries faster, which is good for business. And then also the result of a crackdown could mean that, you know, undocumented workers or immigrants are unfairly targeted because delivery drivers tend to be, you know, immigrants tend to be people of color, tend to be people from immigrant communities. And so what do you think about this idea of trying to eliminate these bikes?
I feel like I've been doing all the talking so far, but I looked this up, but if you go ahead.
No, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I thought that I couldn't hear it anymore.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I looked up, I was kind of curious about this because I read about this story, and I'm someone who rides a bike around New York City, and I use the bike lanes. Right. And I've been a little frustrated by these e-bikes, mostly, and I think it's not the fact that someone's put a very quiet electric battery on a bike. I think it actually kind of boils down to cyclists, all mm-hmm. of us, following the traffic laws.
Oh, yes.
And part of what's, and the thing is, these batteries, it's kind of like driving a Prius. You won't hear it come down the street. Very, mm-hmm. very right. quiet.
Towards so, you in a one-way
yeah.
lane.
So yeah. if someone's coming up behind you on one of these things, you will not hear them coming the way you would, even if someone's just pedaling a bike, because you'll hear their chain. You're supposed to ring a bell, mm-hmm. say something. You're supposed to stop at red lights. You're supposed to not ride on the sidewalk. And I think that's part of the issue. But I was kind of looking up the bike rules and lane rules, and I found something very interesting that I didn't even know about. If you go to newyorkcity.gov, there's the whole bike section, and there's actually commercial biking is its own. There are administrative codes around this, and a lot of this is in place for the safety of the cyclists. Yeah. Even if you're just delivering food, there are things like commercial cyclists safety posters that you have to hang up in your establishment, whether you're running a courier service or a restaurant, the same way you'd have any other like OSHA sort of yeah. thing up. So there's your safety things. There's actually a form of there are certain things your boss has to provide for you. They're supposed to, like, you know, things like reflective vests, safe, you know, helmets. The bike itself, they're supposed to provide the bike, and there's actually little ID cards that you can promote that the city provide that you give to your employee out on the bike, which I think could address the whole, like, is this in kind of an image, could this, like, you know, be an immigration crackdown, because mm-hmm. if someone was pulled over on one of these bikes, they'll have this ID card that says what their name is, but also the employer, who it is you're working for, and they can be referred back there. And it's ultimately the employer's responsibility to provide a safe bike. So whoever, you know, this whole, it in theory, it's the employers that are putting the batteries on the bikes then. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think you have to address the people who are actually sending these guys out to deliver. But I think a lot of it's if you want to, if you're concerned about safety, yeah, I've had some safety issues around these guys, and it has to do with the fact that they're driving them like cars, not mm-hmm. like bikes. And, you know,
well, they're not, I don't even necessarily, they're driving them like cars, because they're not following the same
yeah, it's
rules
a safety,
that cars
yeah,
would follow.
Right, which bikes know? Have to follow also. Yeah. But yeah, I didn't realize there's a whole administrative code around, you know, delivery bike guys and gals, and, you know, and I think maybe we have to, like, think about enforcing the law already in yeah. place. here.
I feel like, you know, you as a driver of a vehicle, of a car, you have to, you know, certify, you have to get a license, you have to show that you, you know, can operate that motor vehicle safely. I don't know that you'd have to get that same license for these. I know for a motorcycle you do, but for these bikes with, you know, these little batteries, these, you don't have to do that. Just like you don't have to get a license for a bicycle in the same way to operate right. a bicycle, but they're operating on the roads. Should we look at these laws and maybe, I don't know if we necessarily can force people to go through like a bike driving course or something, but should we evaluate how many bikes we have on the roads and how prepared people are to ride their bike in the city on the streets?
I think maybe so, but I think if anything, we should be, I think the bike is or can be a better alternative to cars. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we have too many cars in the street. Mm-hmm. As a biker, I'm more concerned about cars mm-hmm. often not following, you know, directions.
Right, right.
Or
yes, not to say that all cars follow the laws either. Right,
right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A car can do a lot more yeah. damage to mm-hmm. a cyclist right, than the other way around.
Yeah. I just think it's sort of coming out of nowhere from de Blasio. Like, I don't know why he's targeting bikes right now. I don't know why he's targeting this group right now. It's so close to the election, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What does he stand to gain, and what do we stand to gain from that?
You know? It did seem to kind of come out of left field, and you wonder kind of who's in his ear
right.
about this issue. Yeah.
And there is actually, speaking of what you were just talking about, there are bicycle safety courses for commercial bicyclists.
Okay.
This, I didn't even know this was a thing. I just in yeah. researching this story because I was really curious about it. I discovered, and this is widely available information, newyorkcity.gov, nyc.gov. You can look into all this, and it's interesting. I feel like we already have this kind of written out the way it's supposed to be, and maybe it's just it's
followed.
But it is yeah. a little funny that he suddenly decided to address this. Is he maybe concerned about employee safety? I would hope so, but I mean, but yeah, a lot of it's things like, you know, just. They need to, they can go a bit faster than your average bicycle. I think it's a fine thing, but people just, I think what they need to do is like pull people over and ticket them when they're like right. doing things they shouldn't in traffic.
Okay. This Slate article said that e-bikes are technically illegal in New York City.
Okay.
So that's why there's not like a system for enforcement there right now. They're legal in other cities, like big cities, San Francisco, I saw, and other like American cities. And then abroad, like I think the British version of Seamless uses them as part of their fleet of delivery vehicles. But we don't have an apparatus for like, measuring their safety right now or enforcing it. And I don't know why he's not going towards the path of legalization and enforcement rather than just like crackdown.
Yeah, make them safer, put some regulations in place mm-hmm. instead of just eliminating them
right.
where people wouldn't have alternatives. Right. Seems like a better option. Well, let's take a moment. We'll listen to some music and then we'll come back and talk about the Me Too campaign that has taken over social media and caused a lot of conversation about how we interact with others and how we discuss sexual assault in the workplace and outside of it. We'll be right back on Objection to the Rule in just a few moments. You and me together, stars forever. You and me together, stars forever. You and me together, stars forever.
The hood of my car, Saturday night, watching
Welcome back to Objection to the Rule live on Radio Free Brooklyn. So if you've opened up your Facebook or your Twitter feed or any social media this week, you've probably seen it. Hashtag Me Too. Hundreds of posts showing solidarity, showing affirmation, letting the world know that they're a part of this major group of people that have somehow experienced harassment, sexual violence in their lives. It's a movement that's for women to share their stories of harassment in public, and it's taken off and is getting stronger. It was started by an activist for women of color called named Tarana Burke, and it's spurred by a tweet from Melissa Milano from Charmed, one of my favorite shows. Me Too opens up the space to talk about anything from street harassment to rape and other types of sexual violence. And most importantly, it doesn't require women to talk about it at all. All you have to say is Me Too, and it lets you know that you are a part of this movement. After dozens of women came forward and spoke publicly about Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein's history of sexual violence, this movement came to fruition, and it's to demonstrate how entrenched gender-based harassment is in our society and how little we think of it. And it's been very interesting to see all of the different responses. Some people have shared their experiences. Some people have simply said Me Too. We're going to play a little bit of some responses from several senators who have also experienced some sort of sexual violence or sexual harassment. And we'll listen to that right now.
When I started out as North Dakota's Attorney General, one of the most significant things I wanted to do was I wanted to change the dynamic of domestic violence. And I had an event when I was speaking, and it was a retired officer. I was talking about what happens to women and what happens when there's violence in the home. And after I got done, this very much older law enforcement official came up to me, and he pretty much put his finger in my face, and he said, "Listen here. Men will always beat their wives, and you can't stop them."
I was a very young state legislator, and in my 20s, and I was single, and I was nervous about getting my first bill out of committee. So I cautiously approached the dais and went up to speak to the very powerful Speaker of the Missouri House of Representatives. And I explained to him the bill I had, and did he have any advice for me on how I could get it out of committee? And he looked at me and he paused and he said, "Well, did you bring your knee pads?"
Usually it's the males who are doing this to women, that they should know that this is not appreciated. It's not cute, it's not fun.
The first women who started the Me Too campaign,
you haven't left anything out, right?
Incredibly brave.
Male front.
And they inspired
That's what they call them on.
The next wave. And in turn, they inspired the next wave and the next wave and the next wave. That's
I'm very hungry, actually. So
those were some responses from some senators, government officials, talking about their experience with sexual violence, sexual harassment in the workplace. The campaign originally started really pre-Twitter and Facebook from an activist named Tarana Burke. And we're going to play a little bit of her reasoning on why she started Me Too, really to help support Black women in the industry.
You started this hashtag movement in 2006, and you focused on what you called empowerment through empathy. What do you mean by that?
I mean, well, so Me Too started not as a hashtag. It started as a campaign of an organization that I founded, Just Be Inc. And empowerment through empathy was the thing that I felt that helped me, which was that other survivors who empathized with my situation helped me to feel like I wasn't alone and gave me sort of entry into my healing journey.
At first, your work focused on women of color, and it's now expanded. Tell me about how it's changed.
Well, my focus in all the work that I do is for the most marginalized people. And so I worked with young women of color in the South. And then when we moved our work into, like, we had like a MySpace page, and women started coming forward and talking to us and saying, "Thank you for this," and "We needed it." And we realized it had to expand to more than young people. And so we worked with young women, mostly Black and brown women, across, you know, through our MySpace page, but also throughout the South and then later in Philadelphia and New York.
You know, we're hearing critics of this campaign say.
So that was Tarana Burke talking about why she started the campaign, which, like we said, started before, you know, Facebook and Twitter. It started on MySpace, which I think is interesting to even hear right now. But, you know, we heard from women that, you know, this has been something that's been a part of their careers. And, you know, looking at Facebook, I've seen so many women I know that have used this hashtag and talk about their experience. I'm curious to know, first, you know, from Violet and Rachel, what was your response when you first saw the campaign? And what were your thoughts when, you know, this kind of blew up on social media?
Well, I didn't realize how big it was at first. You know, I just saw my friends posting it. And, you know, of course, I've also experienced forms of harassment. So I posted it myself and got certain responses from that. But when I saw how big it was, I thought it was interesting, you know, because it's different things for different people. Like, for some people, it's a platform to speak out and to speak their experience, which they may not have had before. But for others, it's just a way to speak in solidarity and to show how big it is.
Likewise, I didn't, it was like, wow, this is a bigger, it really, and not that it, I didn't realize it was a huge problem, but it just, how open, how many people were so open about it. And I mean, if we include under the hashtag, you know, Me Too, it's just any form of sexual harassment. I mean, that was the thing too. It's like, I thought about it and I went, do I have any peers, anyone like who grew up my age, grew up in New York City that didn't experience, we all experienced street harassment. Mm-hmm. I experience it less now, but more in certain neighborhoods, but it used to be, you just, and
cat calling.
You realize how unacceptable it really is. I mean, I knew this, but it was a period of reflection for me. Cause it's like, you know, how could no one have like jumped in back then and seeing like, and not young women, girls being street harassed, like, you know, have, you didn't know you, like, I'm someone who would like just say, no, you don't speak to those children, basically that way. But, you know, I'm someone who used that hashtag. I was really impressed by how many people came, and people I knew didn't just use it, but told detailed stories about what happened to them. And these are people, maybe women are a little older than myself, so I think they might be at a point in their life and in healing, in the process of recovering from everything, that they're ready to share this. But really intimate details about their lives, that people were being open. You talk about trying to stir empathy. If that was the goal, I think that was the intention, I think that was reaching. For me, it was just kind of like, wow, this, I mean, I knew a lot of women that I know who are close to me have gone through this. The details, though, were really, I mean, I was weepy over for some women I've known for years. I did not know they went through such horrifying things at young ages, too, some of them. So I think, you know, I'm really, if the intention was empathy, I think that it was successful. But I also noticed a lot of men using Me Too, not men too, though. I know it was out there, but men I knew were saying Me Too, but they were just sort of saying, yeah, like, it's important to talk about this, but without hijacking it, like making it, oh no, yeah, it's not just about women. But I was very pleased, and I wasn't pleased to see that so many men that I know and care about were victims also, but I was pleased to see, like, hey, we're going to ignore the whole boys don't cry thing. Men were opening up and talking about it. And I'm like, if this helps men to get, because, you know, we talk about things like toxic masculinity. I'm a woman. I'm not going to like jump into something I don't know about. But I feel like part of that is this whole thing where men are, you know, not allowed to express emotions, or that's the expectation.
Yeah.
And everyone all of a sudden was able to express all of this. And I think maybe we're able to all help each other out a little bit in this. It's rough, but it's raw, but it spurred a lot of empathy, I think.
Well, I think that was an interesting, because there have been discussions about where was men's place in this campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, both recognizing that many times, oftentimes in these women's lives, men were the aggressors, and also recognizing that men can be victims too. You can be a victim and an aggressor. You can be just a victim. You know, it doesn't necessarily say that, you know, men are always going to be out there, you know, and not all men, but we talk about culture and we talk about toxic masculinity, and we know that sometimes the silence or the, you know, the quiet support is just as damning as the comments or the jokes. Or, you know, there was the story about how Quentin Tarantino, you know, is saying that he knew about Harvey Weinstein's behavior.
I've heard from a lot of men who said, you know, I'm realizing now that I was complicit in this.
Complicit, yes.
20 years ago, I was complicit in something, or I crossed lines. You know, maybe I made a statement I shouldn't have, or I laughed at something at someone else's pain. You know, those seem like more minor things, but that's a big thing. If everyone takes a step back and goes, wow, I need to assess how I behave in certain things. But yeah, a lot of people have come forward and said, yeah, I didn't say anything. And, you know,
and I think that's a big thing.
Really, like, you know, it lends more credibility to people who accuse, especially like big time people like Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, these powerful, rich and powerful, and rich power in the entertainment industry. That's its whole other thing. When because people are
it
saying,
is a world.
Yeah, it's a world, and it gives much more credibility and credence to people who make accusations, which I think is a good thing if they're honest accusations, you know.
Donato, what did you see? I don't know. What did you experience kind of over the past week with this campaign? Did you have a lot of friends that said it? Did you kind of, what were your reactions?
Yeah. I've definitely on the Facebook been seeing a lot of friends come forward and tell their stories. And then just yesterday I was listening to the Represent podcast. They went into the Harvey Weinstein thing, and they were talking about the hashtag, and I know as I was seeing it, I kept thinking, all right, what next though? But what's next? Because I think we're going to start to see, or at least I'm sure we are going to start to see people say, all right, so we're opened up. Mm-hmm. We got the discussion going. All right. So now what's the next course of action? Because a lot of this stuff does need to get addressed. Mm-hmm. Just watching and looking at all the stories and seeing the hashtag and hearing and reading the stories, I was thinking to myself, you know, all the times, you know, it's just the fellas hanging out, conversating at work, whatnot. And the types of, you know, there's that whole thing like around when the Trump thing came out, everyone was like, oh, locker room talk kind of thing, as opposed to when it, you know, because there are those times when you are just, you know, hanging with everyone does it. You're just, you know, shooting the shit, whatnot. But then there comes that moment of addressing it. Because I too have been in conversations with people where I can tell they just, their views on just, like, as far as like saying something very sexist or very misogynist. And everyone kind of does this thing of like, you know, you kind of like don't want to point it out. And hopefully, you know, just to start things off, we can get more people just like holding themselves accountable or just holding their friends accountable as far as from what men can do.
And that's it. You know, it's a good point. I remember talking about this, how this is a cultural problem. And, you know, just like I feel like racism, you know, in my opinion, racism is something that has to be fixed by white people. I feel like misogyny and mistreatment of women is something that's squarely in the place of men to fix a lot of times, because many times we're the perpetrators, whether it's directly or indirectly. But I think culturally also there is talking about it and bringing it out in the open and having things like this where people are empowered to share their stories. We have to now listen and we have to absorb and we have to act. And I am curious, like you, what is this going to change? Because Harvey Weinstein wasn't the only person.
No.
Bill Cosby wasn't the only person. You know, these stories are, even if they get to the surface and they get visible, you know, there are so many that don't. You know, so I'm hoping that we are at a place where now it's like, well, you know, we have this, my friends have the saying, you know, the skirt's been lifted up, which is kind of a funny saying in this context. now that I say it, but you know, it means, you know, we now with it's been exposed, things have been exposed. And, you know, what do you think we can do to help change this toxic culture that perpetuates this violence?
I think part of something I've talked about with friends is I don't know about for you guys, but like just in high school or middle school, as far as when it came to like health class or classes on sex ed or whatnot, I'm not sure why it's not mandatory that like for every young person, there's like this, like just spend a week on just like how to behave and how to conduct oneself and how to treat people with respect.
I feel like that's something. Go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, when we think, you know, think about, someone I saw this online as a suggestion that, you know, they should be teaching things like boundaries in kindergarten. Someone else came back with, parents should teach that in schools, should reinforce it. But remember that, you know, the saying of everything I need to learn to know in life I learned in kindergarten. When we look at, but look, in preschool and these really young formative grades where we are learning things like turn-taking, please and thank you, certain social graces and things like that, we also need to learn some boundaries like when it's okay to touch, and or even things like, hey, ask, can I give you a hug? Like, it can start, and it, not to sexualize it at all, but at a young age, it's like, okay, what's an acceptable boundaries? You know, like not going through your friend's backpack. You know, we teach, and that, I mean, it should begin at home, but the schools can reinforce that. That is something we can learn in school. You get more into, should be more sophisticated. Yeah, I think health class in high school, especially, because by then you have the raging hormones and people are, you know, they're becoming young adults. But we can start very young, and we can start with creating a culture in schools where children spend so much of their day of, you know, it's okay to talk. And this is how we do it without, you know, if you're upset, verbalize it. And it's okay for the boys and the girls to do that. And we don't make fun of each other if we cry. And we don't, you know, they create these cultures of, you know, verbalizing how we're feeling. I know I have a little nephew who's in first grade, and he lives in New Jersey. And I saw him yesterday, and his dad, my brother, said that there's actually, it's falling under the guise of these anti-bullying programs, but they're teaching these kids to really verbalize their emotions a lot. And but we can apply that to just boundaries in general. I mean, bullying has to do with control and things like that, and they're all tied in. But we can start very young by including that. If we can include turn taking, please and thank you, being good to your fellow classmate, we can try to teach some boundaries at a young age.
Absolutely. Any final thoughts? It was a shocking campaign, and I think that one of my favorite sayings is, you know, when we know better, we do better. And now we can't say that we don't know. Like, if you've been in front of any screen, you know, you can't say that you don't know. And now it's about how do we implement this knowledge into action? And hopefully we'll see that, you know, coming soon. So coming up after this short break, we're going to talk to some people involved with a very interesting film that debuted at the Bushwick Film Festival, tackling race in a very interesting way. And we'll hear from people involved with Black People Are Dangerous coming up next on Objection to the Rule.
Damn, baby, baby.
I gotta hear me.
Damn, baby, baby.
Damn.
Damn, baby.
Sing my songs, strong in my gun, not good for my body. I change it up, see me never like that in your own body. My life's best left, I've never been afraid to switch on down on me. Show me love, that being a virgin, no. Turn it back, don't you shake the room. Bang, bang, it on the minute. You gotta get up off that great line. Can't nobody tell you what you can't do. Shut that down all the magic. And I guarantee the fall in line.
What you wanna go down, what you wanna go.
Watching them all go,
damn.
Ooh,
huh.
Watching them all go,
damn, baby.
Welcome back to Objection to the Rule, live on Radio Free Brooklyn. So, an interesting film debuted at the Bushwick Film Festival this week, and it took a look at, you know, one of the topics that is very central to what we talk about, which is race and our biases around race. And so this film gives a look, it's a short film that kind of gives a look at how these biases perpetuate. And now I'll let the people that made it talk about it. We're joined in the studio by Donato Prescott, who's been joining us all hour. And we also have actors Frank Hartz and Isabella Mihil on the line. They're all from the short film Black People Are Dangerous. Everyone, thank you so much for joining us on Objection to the Rule.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. Frank, Leo, yeah, you there?
Yeah.
Nice.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. So, Donato, first give us a little brief synopsis of the film and what Black People Are Dangerous is.
It is a short film, 13 minutes. It is about a hitchhiker who catches a ride with a black man. It's backwoods, California. They hear on the radio that there's a cannibal serial killer on the loose, and the hitchhiker starts assuming that the man that picked her up is that killer, and she starts making general assumptions. And then they start to have a conversation about race, and you know, his rebuttal is like, well, most serial killers are white. Mm-hmm. Then they get into the whole race discussion, and I don't want to give away the ending, but it, you know, it has an open ending. But yeah, that would be the synopsis. It was,
I'm curious, why did you choose to tackle the subject of race and those racial biases in this film?
For me, there's a lot of reasons. I wrote this around the time when, you know, we were getting a lot of, you know, there was a lot of the shootings of the unarmed black men, and just being black, there is this way that one, you know, society or just the culture puts on you that there's a way you got to conduct yourself, or you do walk around having people like put that on you where you feel like you're made to feel like a threat before you even open your mouth. Mm-hmm. And the combination of just dealing with that, you know, from the time you're born, and then a lot of what was going on, I thought it would be interesting to tackle that in a way that wasn't didactic. Mm-hmm. I don't like when we do any social commentary when it gets too preachy.
Yeah.
But I feel like this is a good way. I think when you can do a story like this in a way that not only entertains, something that you could even laugh at, it mm-hmm. could be more effective.
Absolutely. Yeah. The film didn't really, like, you could tell that they were going to get into these topics, but it really wasn't. It wasn't preachy. It wasn't about, you know, kind of beating you over the head right. with this viewpoint, you know, racism is bad. But it kind of played out some really real ways that racism and bias manifest. So on the phone, Isabella, I'm curious, and Frank, I want to ask you too, what was it like to play these characters and to kind of tell this real world story in this way? Isabella, you can go first.
Yeah, I mean, when I read the script, I loved it, but I also was cringing at all of the lines that I was going to have yeah. to say as Carla.
You do have some cringeworthy lines, for sure.
Yeah, and even just watching the film with an audience, like there were, you know, black and white people on either side of me, and they were both hating Carla, but also kind of laughing at her, and maybe sort of like, I don't know if laughing at her is the right word. I think that, like, the challenge with it, with playing this character, was making sure that Carla was likable, because you likable enough that, like, people would be able to see themselves or see someone they know in her. Because if she was too sort of, like, aggressive with her ignorance and aggressive with her racism and all of that, then people would just sort of put her in a box that's like, oh, I'm not like that person. I don't have those biases. This is just like someone who I can't really relate to. But if she was in some ways a little bit likable and some ways a little bit relatable, then I think it made the film that much more challenging to watch, because while you cringe at the shit she says, mm-hmm. you also feel like, ooh, I know someone who's like that. And I think that was sort of the balance I had to strike working with Donato. And it was a lot of fun. It was hard, but it was a lot of fun.
Frank, what about you? What was it like to play this character? And kind of, you know, if the people haven't seen the movie, but it kind of, there's a shift in kind of the dynamics, which I think is really interesting. So talk about your experience playing it and what you were feeling.
Yeah, man, I think that one of the most interesting things about this script for me, other than the fact that, you know, Donato and I go a little ways back and it's exciting to work together, was that for me, it was just interesting to observe where we've landed since, you know, this, you know, Emancipation Proclamation back in 1863, mm-hmm. when, you know, the 3 million or so slaves were released into to so-called freedom, and we follow them all the way through, you know, so-called middle class and the emergence of rich blacks in America, only to still have the overseers and the so-called plantation owners now sometimes wearing the uniform and as a result killing black men in the streets. And I just found it interesting to see some of those parallels and similarities in the way that characters like Isabel's character sort of saw the world, because you know, as we see a lot of times with these shootings and this profiling that happens, you know, these are so-called good people that go wrong many times. And I think what we're seeing now is, you know, a situation where the most powerful black man in America, President Obama, is now being pulled over and stopped and frisked ever since November. Yeah. And I just, you know, it was interesting to me to see how a character like mine and Black People Are Dangerous dealt with, you know, situations like this in such a subtle fashion. I mean, at any moment he could have, you know, become the monster that, you know, many wanted him to become possibly, but he didn't. He sort of handled it with, you know, grace and dignity and, you know, stated his case. And the problem we're seeing now in the fake news era is that you can state your case all day long. It may work on a car on the side of the road in California, but it doesn't seem to work so much in the halls of Congress when no one is listening and we don't have the power. So hopefully come November and, you know, 2020, we'll be able to get some of that back. But I guess I'm sort of, you know, going on and on from a couple of different angles because there's so much happening and wrapped up in this film that it's hard to place my finger on it. But there's something that I just think is that is resonates and is relevant on so many levels, and I'm still dissecting it and pulling it apart myself. But I think Donato did a great job with the first step of examination.
But I think that's such an interesting, because one of the things that I took away from it is just like how many of those, you know, things that Carla said, for instance, were real things that people say. Yeah. Like, these are real things that people say. And, you know, as a black man myself, I've experienced some of these things, these, you know, these casual racism or microaggressions or whatever you want to call them, that, you know, it's not like somebody is, you know, holding a noose to be dramatic, but these are things that affect you. And you could see how it affected, you know, Frank's character in the movie. You know, you could see him. He was not trying. He didn't want to become that aggressive black man. But, right. you know, when you're getting questioned and challenged, you know, that's kind of how it is. And really was interesting to see. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Did you mention the word? Did you say the word noose?
Noose, yes.
Right. I thought so. That word is interesting to me because I feel like the noose really never left the necks of black people in America.
Yeah.
You know, now you find it in the school board rooms and the halls of Congress and, you know, the streets of America. But, you know, and this isn't for all black people. Some people were able to escape. But in some form, it always seems to appear or reappear around
and
our necks.
Manifest in different ways.
Yeah, in this case, it was...
And, you know, I don't know about you, but when I'm swinging from a noose, I imagine my reactions to certain situations will be much different than if I were free, roaming around, walking without it, you know, strangling me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that my character's reactions in the script with this so-called, you know, metaphorical noose around his neck as a black man in America is, you know, beyond honorable. the way that he reacted to the situation. He even got sliced in the film. You know,
I didn't want to get out of way. that denouement point. It's just a little twist.
It's all good. It's all good.
Man, that's like giving away the end of Crowder.
So we are almost out of time. We only got 45 seconds, but I want Donato to tell us where people can follow the film and where you can hopefully see it sometime soon.
Yeah, right now we're still in submission world, so it's not public, so to speak. But folks can just follow me on, I think, the best way on Instagram, at Don Prescott. And they can go to our Seed and Spark page and just follow the film, and they can stay up to date with the festivals, screenings, and whatnot from there.
All right. Thank you so much, Donato, Isabella, Frank. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to my host. And thank you all for listening to Objections to the Rule. We have What is Love coming up next live on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'll see you next week.
All right. Thanks.